Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for my good friend Steve Bertrand today. You can follow me on Twitter at Glink or on LinkedIn. I encourage everybody to link into me, or you can just go to thinklink.com or bestmoneymoves.com for information on financial wellness and updates. We have a great show for you today. The homeownership rate jumped. We'll talk about that coming up in a little bit. In the meantime, Snapchat has had such a rough go of it since its IPO. Its stock price had an all-time low last week. It's now worth, feel bad for anybody who invested in this right at the outset, worth less than half its peak value. It's also been downgraded by Morgan Stanley. But is Snapchat in trouble? Probably not, according to our next guest, Nick Kinports. He's a principal with SoMe Connect. Nick, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, Elise. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you. So my kids use Snapchat all day long. They're constantly, especially my younger son, making faces into it and doing their own Snapchat stories. This all seems completely confusing to me, but why do you think that Snapchat's not really in trouble?
Well, it could be, and we don't really know. And I'll also start out by disclosing that I do own some Snapchat, which was a recent purchase as it kind of scraped along the bottom, as you mentioned. It's interesting to me. It reminds me of 2012 when Facebook, which is a company that just today has hit a new all-time high, was trading at around 20. And what we saw from our industry, which is advertising and marketing, is that Facebook started to get really smart about how they communicated with us and the data they provided and the options that they provided us to buy and you know, get more advertising going in there. And so I think we were able to see an early pickup in revenue from them and an interest in kind of growing that business. And we're starting to see the same things with Snapchat today.
So with Snapchat, you've got millions and millions of users on the system. And of course, you know everything about them. So wouldn't this be the next huge advertising play? I mean, isn't this, as you like to say, Facebook Redux?
Well, I think it certainly could be. They have to do a really delicate balancing act. And actually, Facebook went through this same thing. I think we can all remember a time when we didn't see advertising in our Facebook news feeds. And now it's literally every other post is an advertisement.
It's
somehow
annoying.
We don't go away. We still use it. So they figured it out. And that's what Snapchat has to do. They have to find out how to balance advertising with fun and interesting content to keep those very young demographic that they've managed to capture still engaged with it.
So 4 out of 5 millennials actually use Snapchat. That's an incredible number when you look at the number of millennials out there, almost 80 million millennials. And to think that, you know, some 60 million of them or 62 million of them are actually on Snapchat. This seems like a can't miss proposition. What could go wrong?
Well, I think that they could potentially create a situation where they're not providing enough information to the advertisers, so they sort of get into this bucket of nice-to-haves rather than must-haves. And I think Facebook and YouTube and, you know, the other Google properties certainly fall into that must-have for all marketers today. And we get so much from them in terms of tracking and information when we spend money in those platforms on behalf of our clients. We don't get that from Snapchat today. They're promising we will get more in the near future, and we're waiting to see if that's going to be true or not. But they certainly seem to be more interested now in working with us since they went public.
I have to say, when you look at the Twitter reports that you can get just from clicking on, you know, a button if you're in the system, it's incredible. I can see how many people follow me, what their net worth is, what they like to shop, their primary area of interest. So many other things, and I know you can get very similar sorts of statistics on Google, on YouTube, and all the rest. Is Facebook giving it just any sort of a timeline when you might see this?
So I think that Snapchat will come around here in the next 6 months, and I think we'll start to see some new products from them, both new types of ads to buy or to, you know, potentially try out, and also some new information that we can get after we make those buys on behalf of our clients. I think, you know, Facebook just does such an incredible job of this, and they're always getting better at it. You may have seen that in the last year or so, you could start to have reactions to Facebook posts. So you could say you love something or you hate
it, sad.
Things like that. Yeah. And we started to mine that data and then, you know, feed that back to our clients. So now we're also doing kind of market research while we're creating content and posting that out into Facebook and, you know, driving it to very, very specific targeted audiences.
Yeah, it's really all about niche, and I think it'll be about niche going forward. Nick Kenports, thanks for coming with us today and explaining a little bit about Snapchat. Nick is a principal with SoMe Connect. Is there a website that people can go to, Nick?
Yeah, that's SOMEConnect.com.
Terrific. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Gling, sitting in for Steve Bertrand, and I hope you'll link into me or follow me on Twitter at Glink, thinklink.com. So it's time for Bill Geiger with Geiger Wealth Management. He comes on our show, and his visits with us are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Welcome back.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
It's nice to have you. So my company, Best Money Moves, actually measures financial stress, and we know that staying up all night is a real sign that you're in trouble, right?
Well, either you're in trouble or you're worried about the future.
Yeah.
One of the two. If you think about the number one worry that we see is people outliving their money in retirement. And the key to sleeping at night is to basically have a lot of income in retirement. I've never seen anybody with a lot of income that wasn't comfortable in retirement.
Yeah, I think that insomnia, the 2 in 5 Americans are actually losing sleep over healthcare costs alone, and then you've got mortgage costs and credit card bills, and we all know that baby boomers haven't met a debt they didn't like.
Right.
That can really be nerve-wracking for sure. How do you talk to your clients about their retirement and having that kind of regular income stream in retirement? Because even if you're 10 or 15 or 20 years out, knowing mm-hmm. that's coming down the pike, if you're strapped today, but you know in the future it's going to be okay, that's got to help, right?
Well, it's got to help, but there's a lot of unsuredness, if you will. I was sitting down with a 60-year-old couple last week who'd done all the right things. They saved, they controlled their spending. They ended up right now with a $1.2 million portfolio.
That seems like a lot of money.
Well, it seems like a lot, but I'm sitting down talking to them, and the wife says to me, Bill, she goes, I'm happy with what we've got. She goes, but I'm uncomfortable about whether we're going to be able to continue living the way we want to and not run out of money somewhere down the road.
Yeah, and that's a concern when you've got only, interest rates are so low and banks are giving you 1%.
Right.
It's not like you can live off the interest.
No, you can't. And the husband came right back after that. He says, look, he says, I'm really happy about the market going up, setting all-time highs every day. He says, but at the same time, I'm really worried about having a big loss this close to our retirement.
Sure. I mean, think about all the people back in 2009 when the market was down at like 6,600. And they were completely freaked out.
Yeah, if you were 65 years old at that time, you were really freaked out because your whole life changed.
Yeah.
So what we did with these folks, and this is kind of a pattern that works really well, is we took part of their portfolio to create sustainable, dependable income for them.
Mm-hmm.
That, with their Social Securities, is going to give them a six-figure, comfortable income throughout retirement that they can depend upon. The rest of the money we took and invested for conservative growth, and that's to stay up with inflation over an extended period of time. So you put those two things together, and they can sleep better now.
So conservative growth, you're looking at, I mean, inflation's ridiculously low. We're not even at the Fed target right now, right? Which would be around 2%, and I think we're running, what, between 1 and 1.5?
Yeah, if that, yeah.
So is that the kind of, are you looking for growth at 2 to 3% when you
say
conservative or even lower?
No, higher than
higher
that.
Higher than that.
Higher than that. The big deal, if you're late 50s, early 60s, the big deal is not having a big loss at this stage of your life.
Sure.
And if you just don't have a big loss, you can have some really good numbers just by protecting your downside. We've got managers that are managing exceptionally more than that. I'm not going to say any numbers on the air because I'll have every regulator in the world talking to me tomorrow.
We're not, and let's just be very clear, we'll say that past performance is no guarantee of
future results,
right?
Exactly. But much better than that. And the key, The key is just not to have big losses. If you can stay involved in the market and just not have big losses, you'll do spectacular.
Right. It's really a nice thing. Now, it used to be the rule of thumb is that you could withdraw 4% of your principal balance and basically never run out of money. Is that true anymore?
No, it's not.
Not even close.
Not even close. It used to be 4 to 6%.
Right.
In the early 2000s, they knocked it down to 4. And in 2009, the financial planning community came back and said, you better not take more than 3% out of a market-based portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a fighting chance and not running out of money.
So just so people understand, 3% on $1.2 million isn't very much to live on, right?
No, it's $36,000 a year.
Yeah.
And there's still no assurance that you're not going to run out of money. That's why it's so important to take a portion of your portfolio and really allocate it toward income, not for growth. So I know you're going to talk about this in just a moment, but let me kind of very briefly talk about what we're going to do special for folks. The next five callers who call in that meet some criteria you're going to talk about, I'm going to sit down with them personally, and on a complimentary basis, I'm going to help them put together a full-blown plan for their retirement, soup to nuts.
Well, that sounds like it'll really help, and they should bring all of their shoeboxes with them.
Absolutely.
With all their receipts and everything else in it.
Absolutely.
Bill, thank you so much for coming on the show again today. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for Steve Bertrand today. So glad you could join us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Be sure to follow me on Twitter, @Glink, or on LinkedIn. Or if you're interested in financial wellness information, try bestmoneymoves.com. All right, so here's something sort of new, co-living. I thought I'd heard it all when it came to real estate, and certainly we're seeing the number of homeowners outpace renters for the only second time in 11 years. Our guest today, Matt Bacher is with Common Living, but David Herrera, who's the founder and CEO of something called Golden Mean,
right? The Golden Mean Group.
The Golden Mean Group. It doesn't say group on your card. It just has this nice gold. Is it real gold? No, I'm just kidding.
One troy ounce of gold.
Perfect. He's a building developer and a housing activist, and he is doing some really interesting things in Chicago's Ukrainian Village. So let's start with what co-living is.
So co-living is it's shared space. It's shared.
Am I sharing
space.
My bedroom like I did when I was in college?
So it's like roommates, having roommates.
Having roommates in the same room? No.
I'll defer to Matt on that. He's the co-living guru.
No, it's not having roommates in the same room. So we're not taking bunk beds and stocking them up with people and shoving them in. What we're actually doing is we're taking a traditional unit, and what we'll do is we'll set it up so that there will be four beds within the unit. And those four beds will be filled by people from all over the country, some local. And it provides them the ability to come into a community right away and have an additional opportunity for housing and additional choice for housing as opposed to a traditional studio or one bedroom or maybe finding a roommate on Craigslist or something along those lines.
So are these – okay, so one of my sons is in college, and they're living in what's known as a quad. They've got four separate small bedrooms and kind of a co-living space in the middle where they all kind of get together. Is that what your building looks like?
Essentially, the building is a four-bedroom apartment.
Okay.
And it's not quite a quad. It's kind of more rectangular in shape, but 1,600 square feet. And there's four individual rooms, and essentially you'd have four roommates living in there. So versus moving into Chicago, finding a three-bedroom apartment, and then kind of hunting for your roommates on Craigslist.
Mm-hmm. Common, you guys provide the roommates.
Common does the background checks, and they do the interviews, and they vet the individual roommates. So you'd have four in this building. It'd be four separate roommates per unit.
Okay, so there's this kind of shared living environment, kind of like college. And is this something that, I know you're targeting millennials, both of you look to be millennial. I have kids who are millennials, so there's certainly a generational thing here. But what if I don't like the, is it all single sex? Is it, you know, you mix it up, it's two women, two men? You know, what if I don't like them?
Sure, so it's actually completely mixed up. We try not to look at it as like, oh, here's a men's home or here's a woman's home. If you're unhappy with the people that are in your suite, perhaps, we'll try and have you work that out with them. And then if that doesn't work, you actually have the ability to transfer homes or suites within Common, within your own lease. It's more so used when let's say we opened a new home in Chicago and you're like, oh, I love that home. It's closer to work. Then you can actually transfer within your own lease to that home and into that community.
Okay. And so what do I do with all my stuff? Because there's no apartment, and I mean, you have like a little closet, right?
Well,
so
if you're a millennial, you might not have a lot of furniture. You have not had
meant clothes. I didn't even think about furniture.
You haven't had the ability to acquire furniture, right, at an early stage in your career.
Right.
Potentially.
Okay. And so what about bathrooms?
You can take that with as well.
You can take your bathroom? I have a toilet.
We'll have a bathroom.
It's got one Troy Gold ounce in it. So are the bathrooms, there are four bathrooms for each of the bedrooms, or you share the bathroom as well?
So it's commonly a shared bathroom situation. We usually strive to have it so that two bedrooms will share a bathroom at max.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, we also have a maid service that comes once a week to clean all of the common areas. They won't go into your bedrooms, but they will clean the kitchen, bathroom, living room, as well as the common area that we usually have for all of the people within a home to be able to share.
Okay, so the property is located at 2048 West Chicago, is that right?
Correct. Yes.
And how did you come up with this idea to just build one of these things, and how's it doing so far? And when does it open?
So, I grew up in Ukrainian Village, born and raised. I've seen it gentrify over the last 30 years. My parents grew up there, and they've seen a lot more of the trend. Urban infills in, and I just decided, hey, you know, why not build a property and keep it as a rental property within my portfolio? Originally, it was a spec build. I was going to live on the top penthouse floor, lease out the rest of the building, and then kind of, you know, I was going to live rent-free, essentially. The rents would have paid.
Listen, as a real estate person, I love that idea.
And then I ran into the common folks. They came, they took a tour. They like the property. They don't take... As far as I know, they don't.
Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for my good friend Steve Bertrand today. You can follow me on Twitter at Glink or on LinkedIn. I encourage everybody to link into me, or you can just go to thinklink.com or bestmoneymoves.com for information on financial wellness and updates. We have a great show for you today. The homeownership rate jumped. We'll talk about that coming up in a little bit. In the meantime, Snapchat has had such a rough go of it since its IPO. Its stock price had an all-time low last week. It's now worth, feel bad for anybody who invested in this right at the outset, worth less than half its peak value. It's also been downgraded by Morgan Stanley. But is Snapchat in trouble? Probably not, according to our next guest, Nick Kinports. He's a principal with SoMe Connect. Nick, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, Elise. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you. So my kids use Snapchat all day long. They're constantly, especially my younger son, making faces into it and doing their own Snapchat stories. This all seems completely confusing to me, but why do you think that Snapchat's not really in trouble?
Well, it could be, and we don't really know. And I'll also start out by disclosing that I do own some Snapchat, which was a recent purchase as it kind of scraped along the bottom, as you mentioned. It's interesting to me. It reminds me of 2012 when Facebook, which is a company that just today has hit a new all-time high, was trading at around 20. And what we saw from our industry, which is advertising and marketing, is that Facebook started to get really smart about how they communicated with us and the data they provided and the options that they provided us to buy and you know, get more advertising going in there. And so I think we were able to see an early pickup in revenue from them and an interest in kind of growing that business. And we're starting to see the same things with Snapchat today.
So with Snapchat, you've got millions and millions of users on the system. And of course, you know everything about them. So wouldn't this be the next huge advertising play? I mean, isn't this, as you like to say, Facebook Redux?
Well, I think it certainly could be. They have to do a really delicate balancing act. And actually, Facebook went through this same thing. I think we can all remember a time when we didn't see advertising in our Facebook news feeds. And now it's literally every other post is an advertisement.
It's
somehow
annoying.
We don't go away. We still use it. So they figured it out. And that's what Snapchat has to do. They have to find out how to balance advertising with fun and interesting content to keep those very young demographic that they've managed to capture still engaged with it.
So 4 out of 5 millennials actually use Snapchat. That's an incredible number when you look at the number of millennials out there, almost 80 million millennials. And to think that, you know, some 60 million of them or 62 million of them are actually on Snapchat. This seems like a can't-miss proposition. What could go wrong?
Well, I think that they could potentially create a situation where they're not providing enough information to the advertisers, so they sort of get into this bucket of nice-to-haves rather than must-haves. And I think Facebook and YouTube and, you know, the other Google properties certainly fall into that must-have for all marketers today. And we get so much from them in terms of tracking and information when we spend money in those platforms on behalf of our clients. We don't get that from Snapchat today. They're promising we will get more in the near future, and we're waiting to see if that's going to be true or not. But they certainly seem to be more interested now in working with us since they went public.
I have to say, when you look at the Twitter reports that you can get just from clicking on, you know, a button if you're in the system, it's incredible. I can see how many people follow me, what their net worth is, what they like to shop, their primary area of interest, so many other things. And I know you can get very similar sorts of statistics on Google, on YouTube, and all the rest. Is Facebook giving it just any sort of a timeline when you might see this?
So I think that Snapchat will come around here in the next 6 months. And I think we'll start to see some new products from them, both new types of ads to buy or to, you know, potentially, you know, try out, and also some new information that we can get after we make those buys on behalf of our clients. I think, you know, Facebook just does such an incredible job of this, and they're always getting better at it. You may have seen that in the last year or so, you could start to have reactions to Facebook posts. So you could say you love something or you hate
it,
sad, things like that. Yeah. And we started to mine that data and then, you know, feed that back to our clients. So now we're also doing kind of market research while we're creating content and posting that out into Facebook and, you know, driving it to very, very specific targeted audiences.
Yeah, it's really all about niche, and I think it'll be about niche going forward. Nick Kenports, thanks for coming with us today and explaining a little bit about Snapchat. Nick is a principal with SoMe Connect. Is there a website that people can go to, Nick?
Yeah, that's SOMEConnect.com.
Terrific. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Gling, sitting in for Steve Bertrand, and I hope you'll link into me or follow me on Twitter at Glink, thinklink.com. So it's time for Bill Geiger with Geiger Wealth Management. He comes on our show, and his visits with us are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Welcome back.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
It's nice to have you. So my company, Best Money Moves, actually measures financial stress, and we know that staying up all night is a real sign that you're in trouble, right?
Well, either you're in trouble or you're worried about the future.
Yeah.
One of the two. If you think about the number one worry that we see is people outliving their money in retirement. And the key to sleeping at night is to basically have a lot of income in retirement. I've never seen anybody with a lot of income that wasn't comfortable in retirement.
Yeah, I think that insomnia, the 2 in 5 Americans are actually losing sleep over healthcare costs alone, and then you've got mortgage costs and credit card bills, and we all know that baby boomers haven't met a debt they didn't like.
Right.
That can really be nerve-wracking for sure. How do you talk to your clients about their retirement and having that kind of regular income stream in retirement? Because even if you're 10 or 15 or 20 years out, knowing mm-hmm. that's coming down the pike, if you're strapped today, but you know in the future it's going to be okay, that's got to help, right?
Well, it's got to help, but there's a lot of unsuredness, if you will. I was sitting down with a 60-year-old couple last week who'd done all the right things. They saved, they controlled their spending. They ended up right now with a $1.2 million portfolio.
That seems like a lot of money.
Well, it seems like a lot, but I'm sitting down talking to them, and the wife says to me, Bill, she goes, I'm happy with what we've got. She goes, but I'm uncomfortable about whether we're going to be able to continue living the way we want to and not run out of money somewhere down the road.
Yeah, and that's a concern when you've got only, interest rates are so low and banks are giving you 1%. Right. It's not like you can live off the interest.
No, you can't. And the husband came right back after that. He says, look, he says, I'm really happy about the market going up, setting all-time highs every day. He says, but at the same time, I'm really worried about having a big loss this close to our retirement.
Sure. I mean, think about all the people back in 2009 when the market was down at like 6,600 and they were completely freaked out.
Yeah, if you were 65 years old at that time, you were really freaked out because your whole life changed.
Yeah.
So what we did with these folks, and this is kind of a pattern that works really well, is we took part of their portfolio to create sustainable, dependable income for them.
Mm-hmm.
That with their Social Securities is going to give them a six-figure comfortable income throughout retirement that they can depend upon. The rest of the money we took and invested for conservative growth, and that's to stay up with inflation over an extended period of time. So you put those two things together, and they can sleep better now.
So conservative growth, you're looking at, I mean, inflation's ridiculously low. We're not even at the Fed target right now, right? Which would be around 2%. And I think we're running, what, between 1 and 1.5?
Yeah, if that, yeah.
So is that the kind of, are you looking for growth at 2 to 3% when you say conservative or even lower?
No, higher than that. Higher than that. The big deal, if you're late 50s, early 60s, the big deal is not having a big loss at this stage of your life.
Sure.
And if you just don't have a big loss, you can have some really good numbers just by protecting your downside. We've got managers that are managing exceptionally more than that. I'm not going to say any numbers on the air because I'll have every regulator in the world talking to me tomorrow.
We're not, and let's just be very clear, we'll say that past performance is no guarantee of future results, right?
Exactly. But much better than that. And the key is just not to have big losses. If you can stay involved in the market and just not have big losses, you'll do spectacular.
Right. It's really a nice thing. Now, it used to be the rule of thumb is that you could withdraw 4% of your principal balance and basically never run out of money. Is that true anymore?
No, it's not.
Not even close.
Not even close. It used to be 4 to 6%. In the early 2000s, they knocked it down to 4. And in 2009, the financial planning community came back and said, you better not take more than 3% out of a market-based portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a fighting chance and not running out of money.
So just so people understand, 3% on $1.2 million isn't very much to live on, right?
No, it's $36,000 a year.
Yeah.
And there's still no assurance that you're not going to run out of money. That's why it's so important to take a portion of your portfolio and really allocate it toward income, not for growth. So I know you're going to talk about this in just a moment, but let me kind of very briefly talk about what we're going to do special for folks. The next five callers who call in that meet some criteria you're going to talk about, I'm going to sit down with them personally, and on a complimentary basis, I'm going to help them put together a full-blown plan for their retirement, soup to nuts.
Well, that sounds like it'll really help. And they should bring all of their shoeboxes with them.
Absolutely.
With all their receipts and everything
else
in it.
Absolutely.
Bill, thank you so much for coming on the show again today. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for Steve Bertrand today. So glad you could join us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Glink or on LinkedIn. Or if you're interested in financial wellness information, try bestmoneymoves.com. All right, so here's something sort of new, co-living. I thought I'd heard it all when it came to real estate, and certainly we're seeing the number of homeowners outpace renters for the only second time in 11 years. Our guest today, Matt Bacher is with Common Living, but David Herrera, who's the founder and CEO of something called Golden Mean,
Golden Mean Group.
The Golden Mean Group. It doesn't say group on your card. It just has this nice gold. Is it real gold? No, I'm just kidding.
One troy ounce of gold.
Perfect. He's a building and a building developer and a housing activist, and he is doing some really interesting things in Chicago's Ukrainian Village. So let's start with what co-living is.
So co-living is it's shared space. It's shared.
Am I sharing
space.
My bedroom like I did when I was in college?
So it's like roommates, having roommates.
Having roommates in the same room? No.
I'll defer to Matt on that. He's the co-living guru.
No, it's not having roommates in the same room. So we're not taking bunk beds and stocking them up with people and shoving them in. What we're actually doing is we're taking a traditional unit, and what we'll do is we'll set it up so that there will be four beds within the unit. And those four beds will be filled by people from all over the country, some local. And it provides them the ability to come into a community right away and have an additional opportunity for housing and additional choice for housing, as opposed to a traditional studio or one bedroom or maybe finding a roommate on Craigslist or something along those lines.
So are these – okay, so one of my sons is in college, and they're living in what's known as a quad. They've got four separate small bedrooms and kind of a co-living space in the middle where they all kind of get together. Is that what your building looks like?
Essentially, the building is a four-bedroom apartment.
Okay.
And it's not quite a quad. It's kind of more rectangular in shape, but 1,600 square feet. And there's four individual rooms. And essentially, you'd have four roommates living in there. So versus moving into Chicago, finding a three-bedroom apartment, and then kind of hunting for your roommates on Craigslist.
Mm-hmm. Common, you guys provide the roommates.
Common does the background checks, and they do the interviews, and they vet the individual roommates. So you'd have four in this building. It'd be four separate roommates per unit.
Okay. So there's this kind of shared living environment, kind of like college. And is this something that, I know you're targeting millennials. Both of you look to be millennial. I have kids who are millennials. So there's certainly a generational thing here. But what if I don't like the, is it all single sex? Is it, you know, you mix it up, it's two women, two men. You know, what if I don't like them?
Sure. So it's actually completely mixed up. We try not to look at it as like, oh, here's a men's home or here's a woman's home. If you're unhappy with the people that are in your suite, perhaps, we'll try and have you work that out with them. And then if that doesn't work, you actually have the ability to transfer homes or suites within Common, within your own lease. It's more so used when, let's say we open a new home in Chicago and you're like, oh, I love that home. It's closer to work. Then you can actually transfer within your own lease to that home and into that community.
Okay. And so what do I do with all my stuff? Because there's no apartment, and I mean, you have like a little closet, right?
Well,
so,
if you're a millennial, you might not have a lot of furniture. You have not had
the
ability.
I just meant clothes. I didn't even think about furniture.
You haven't had the ability to acquire furniture, right, at an early stage in your career.
Right.
Potentially.
Okay. And so what about bathrooms?
You can take that with as well.
You can take your bathroom? I have a toilet.
We'll have a bathroom.
It's got one Troy Gold ounce in it. So are the bathrooms, there are four bathrooms for each of the bedrooms, or you share the bathroom as well?
So it's commonly a shared bathroom situation. We usually strive to have it so that two bedrooms will share a bathroom at max.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, we also have a maid service that comes once a week to clean all of the common areas. They won't go into your bedrooms, but they will clean the kitchen, bathroom, living room, as well as the common area that we usually have for all of the people within a home to be able to share.
Okay, so the property is located at 2048 West Chicago, is that right?
Correct. Yes.
And how did you come up with this idea to just build one of these things, and how's it doing so far? And when does it open?
So, I grew up in Ukrainian Village, born and raised. I've seen it gentrify over the last 30 years. My parents grew up there, and they've seen a lot more of the trend. Urban infills in, and I just decided, hey, you know, why not build a property and keep it as a rental property within my portfolio? Originally, it was a spec build. I was going to live on the top penthouse floor, lease out the rest of the building, and then kind of, you know, I was going to live rent-free, essentially. The rents would have paid.
Listen, as a real estate person, I love that idea.
And then I ran into the Common folks. They came, they took a tour. They like the property. They don't take, as far as I know, they don't take individual apartments. They prefer to control the building. And they made me an offer, and I said yes. I'd love to have you guys as a partner, lease it to them, and then they manage the property. I had to do some tenant build outs, tenant improvements. We added a fourth bedroom. They were large units to begin with, and it worked out really well. It looks very nice. So
Matthew, when you look at properties, are there other properties in the Chicago area that you're actually doing this with, or is this the first one, and where else does co-living exist?
Sure. So we're actually right now we're in about four markets. We started in New York. We're in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Chicago is actually our newest market. This is our first home within Chicago. It's 12 bedrooms. We're currently working to open a 14-bedroom as well, a little farther north, and we're hoping to be somewhere around 70-some bedrooms by end of year in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get people in for roommates? Are you advertising on Craigslist? Are you? What do you do to vet the roommates, and where do you find them?
Sure. So I think some of the beauty of Common is that we have a full central office in New York, and it works much like a tech company where we'll do full advertising. We'll put it out there. We do a lot of press that'll help bring people in, and people are really aware of the co-living movement right now for some reason. It seems that they've really taken to it.
It's so, Airbnb, but in a slightly more permanent environment.
In a much more permanent environment. And it people come to us at a great rate because of the fact that a lot of times if you're moving to a new city, you're not moving your furniture. You're coming with a bag. You may not know anybody. My favorite part about Common, the homes are all built out very high end. They're mm-hmm. very nice. This isn't low
yeah,
end.
Yeah, no, I saw your rental rates. They're not cheap.
No, not always. But they are competitive.
And we've had some pretty – we've been marketing, what, 2 weeks now, and they've had great success at the property. How many tours are you guys doing per week?
So currently we're striving to do about 4 to 5 tours a day. And it looks like we're going to be about 50% leased up here within 2 weeks of opening.
So you have 12 bedrooms. That's 6 bedrooms gone, 1.5 of the, you know, of the units. So it's not a big property. It's not like you're looking to lease up 150 units.
Yet.
But you're
well, in this one in this, building, this I don't think you're building
no.
up, right?
No, she's not going up.
I believe there's interest for about 100 tours per week.
Which is really interesting.
They don't all convert, but that's a lot of demand coming to that property
no, it's,
into the concept.
It's a serious amount of demand coming in. It's absolutely fascinating. Common runs how many units nationwide? How many bedrooms?
I'd have to look.
It's 298. With my 12 beds brings them to 298, and then they have 14 opening shortly and add 70 to that, and then you're in other markets, so 300 and growing at this point.
Really interesting. An interesting startup. And when did you guys first kick off?
It was actually beginning of 2015.
So interesting. Well, good luck to both of you, and I'm sure it sounds at 100 people coming in to take a look, you should get that leased up, I would think, fairly soon. So,
thank you.
Good luck, and I hope it works out.
Appreciate it.
All thank right. You. I'm Elise Glink. I'm sitting in for my good friend, Steve Bertrand. You can follow me on Twitter, at Glink, or join me on LinkedIn, thinklink.com, and if you're interested in financial wellness updates, sign up for our weekly newsletter at bestmoneymoves.com. Veronique de Rouget, who is the Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center, she joins us now to talk a little bit more about how much money the government makes every time you step on an airplane or you stay at a hotel. Veronique, welcome to WGN. Not sure why I'm not here. Oh, there we go. Veronique?
Yes. Thank you for having me.
It's very nice to have you on. So how much money does the government make when people travel?
Well, so it depends, right? I mean, so on the roads, like there's a roughly, I guess, 20% of the cost of your gas goes into is a cost that. There's also all the taxes that you pay for infrastructure that usually is subpar. There's also taxes and fees on your plane tickets, which is was a big surprise when I wrote this article to me. I mean, I knew, but I didn't know how much it was, where on some, basically on some tickets, it's roughly 80% of the price, the cost of your ticket as fees and taxes, not all of it going into the pocket of the government, but a lot of it also being going to the airlines as a result of lobbying.
So that's pretty interesting. The idea that you've got this huge amount of money, that 80% of a ticket price could be taxes and fees. I'm always stunned when I go to Hertz or to Budget and I'm renting a car, and I see just how much I'm paying. I mean, I think I'm paying $35 a day for a car, and then the final bill comes, and it's like $62.50.
Yeah, and of course it depends on the states you're in and you're renting in, right? Because some states have even higher rates and fees than others.
Right, Georgia, it seems. I'm often in Georgia, New York, and California renting cars, and it seems like the car rentals there are very, very expensive.
Yes, it is. But, you know, the thing is, like, this is not a phenomenon that's going to go away, and the reason is because government has become bigger and bigger and bigger and spending more money, and so they need to jack up their revenue sources. But another thing that basically, the reason why I was actually looking at all these issues was, like, when you go on vacation, like, how is the government getting in the way of you enjoying yourself? So it's not just government intervention is not just in the form of taxes, and a lot of the time it's all the stuff that government puts in place that actually makes it harder to do anything, to get places, to things that increases your time, and of course it means basically there's like it's the stuff that it's time you spend, you know, complying with government rules as opposed to doing other things.
Well, give us an example of that. I mean, where, you know, give me an example so I understand it, so everybody's listening.
Yeah. So, for instance, like, I mean, I say, you know, like, so you take a plane, you buy your tickets, it start with these big taxes on, but then you have to get to the airport significantly earlier than we used to be because of TSA. And I think there's a lot of reason to argue that it's not making us safer. And then, you know, there's your you get to your point of destination, and there are actually a lot of cities that have banned ride sharing. So basically, you can't get an Uber or a Lyft to get to your final point of destination because the taxi cartel has put pressure on the government to ban those. And so as a result, you pay, either you have to stand in line longer, but also you pay much more than you would if the government allowed, not cave to the pressure of interest group and allow these things. And then let's say you get to your destination and there, and you wanted to get on an Airbnb, but that's not possible because, again, the hotel lobby is actually, you know, made sure that you couldn't do this, or there are restrictions all over the place that when you think about it in terms of like, a model kind of travel experience, I mean, it becomes pretty significant.
It is,
how
but
much
you,
at every step.
Yeah, it is involved, but, you know, there's 325 million people in the U.S., and you can't just let people run amok because everybody's got conflicting interests. Government is there to make sure that there is a road for us to actually ride on, or there are rail tracks so we can have public transportation. Mm-hmm. And so if you just focus on what people are going to pay individually because, you know, they can't do Airbnb when they want to, sure, there's lobbying interests all over the place. What would be nice is if you did remove the lobbying interests, but you can't. I don't think you're going to end up getting away with not having any taxes or fees assessed by the government. Is that what you're proposing?
No. But it's just like when you look at the cumulative effect, it's actually pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's pretty big, and again, a lot of the restrictions that are put on our choices are hard to defend from a consumer point of view.
Right, but user fees are actually a better way, some people think, of levying the taxes that are required to keep government running than having higher income taxes, for example.
Well, so yes and no, but like, for instance, if you take the gas tax, right,
mm-hmm.
like people are under the illusion that they're paying the gas tax to actually fix the roads and everything, but actually at least 25% of the gas tax is going to things that has nothing to do with roads.
Oh, we lost that illusion years ago in the state of Illinois when they told us that the lottery was going to be, proceeds were going to be used to actually fund education. So I don't think
exactly.
anybody here is under the illusion that if you buy a lottery ticket, you're actually supporting education in the state of Illinois anymore.
No, and so, but my point being that there is more and more disconnect between, because like the concept you're right of a fee is one where usually there's a connection between paying for the goods that you're consuming. Well, more and more when you have these fees that go up and up, a lot of the revenue is actually not paying for the thing that you're actually consuming.
Right,
That's problematic.
I agree. It absolutely is problematic. Veronique de Rouget is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center. Thank you so much for being with us today. And a very interesting conversation.
Thank you for having me.